The first stage is foundation. In this phase, an established language, for example, British English, begins sowing its seeds in a new land. Speakers bring dialects of the language with them, and the linguistic effects of these first dialects, called founder effects, can have a profound effect on shaping the new dialect and its sub-dialects. Transplanted dialects also mix with one another. This often results in the leveling out of dialect differences, in the creation of a widespread, sort of neutral variety for general use, what's known as a koiné. A third ingredient is language contact, including lots of borrowing from indigenous peoples in the new land. In the second stage, so-called exonormative stabilization, the linguistic mixture settles a bit and a new language variety begins to stabilize. Differences continue to be leveled out as dialect mixing and language contact continue. There's also linguistic creativity, and people begin to notice new words and new usages they associate with the new colony, so-called isms, as in Americanisms or, say, Australianisms. Typically, new linguistic usages are not well-liked, since people's linguistic orientations and their political and cultural orientations are toward the home country, for example, Great Britain. In the third stage, nativization, the emerging dialect becomes an entity in its own right. English as used in India becomes Indian English, and English in America becomes American English. Leveling and borrowing continue apace, and there's an explosion of linguistic creativity that further widens the gulf between the new dialect and old world variety. But the home language doesn't stand still either, and as time progresses, it too undergoes changes, often in quite different directions from how the language is changing in other lands. Exonormative stabilization still persists until people who speak the new dialect gain enough self-confidence to follow their own linguistic norms. And that's when we enter the fourth stage, endonormative stabilization. In this phase, the newly established dialect is finally given credit. It's no longer considered a substandard offshoot. Now it's a bona fide language variety that can be taught to children, used in business and government, encoded in dictionaries and usage guides, and celebrated in literary works. This stage, a sort of declaration of linguistic independence, tends to follow on the heels of political independence, but it doesn't coincide exactly. The effects of established language standards can persist for a long time. In fact, in America today, we still tend to think that people who speak proper British English must be more cultured than we are, even with no other evidence than dialect alone. So exonormative orientation dies hard, even after generations of endonormative emphasis. Finally, an established New English dialect can enter a fifth stage, differentiation. This happens when the speakers of the new dialect, now citizens of a new nation, become secure in their new identity. They can turn their focus from presenting a united political and linguistic front to considering their own nation-internal cultural and linguistic diversity. Cultural and community groups develop a new sense of pride, a heightened sense of unique identity, and often a more distinctive linguistic identity. And so more distinctive intranational dialects arise. Summed up, Schneider's examination of the historical development of world Englishes leads to a somewhat surprising conclusion. As English spreads across the world, it diversifies across countries and over time within countries. Now, could this really still be happening in this day and age of increasing globalization and internet communication? We'll have more to say on this in upcoming lectures. For now, let's turn back to the earliest days of English in America, the foundation stage, where already linguistic differentiation from England begins to emerge. Again, the first English-speaking settlement in America was Jamestown in the Tidewater, Virginia area. Most of the early English-speaking settlers in the Tidewater region came from southern and southwestern England. They were Cavaliers, royalists who left England as a result of the English Civil War that unseated their king. They were gentrified, conservative, and oriented toward England despite their distance. Also traveling along with the Cavaliers were people of a very different social class, indentured servants who received passage to the New World in exchange for a period of servitude on the wealthy Cavaliers' extensive farmlands. So the seeds of pre-Civil War Southern aristocratic plantation culture so familiar to us from depictions like those in Gone with the Wind, were sown from the outset. All told, about 40,000 cavaliers and servants arrived in the first three quarters of the 17th century. And their ways of life and ways of talking were to have persistent founder effects on Southern culture and on the Southern dialect.